The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition today. We're going to take a question that's come in, not use it on a Q&A show, but use it for our EDU show, where we dig into just this one particular question, because we think it's an interesting topic, and Jim's going to share that with us here momentarily. I've got him joining us remotely from the homestead. You'll know that immediately because it'll sound like he's on the phone, which he is. But so far, as I've been talking to him, it's been a nice, clean connection. So hopefully that will stick with us. Jim, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
So far, so good.
Excellent. Do I have the phone voice?
Yes, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, not much I can do about phone voice, kind of like morning breath. It just happens. But as long as I'm at home, as long as we keep recording these on Fridays, I'm afraid my phone voice is going to continue.
Yep.
Because I tend to stay home on Fridays and work from here. Okay. Anyways, this question is one that I chose for today's EDU for two reasons. It's kind of a straightforward, easy question, but the art in financial planning could really go with this. I think if this question was presented, Chris, to 3, 4, 5 different financial advisors, you would get 3, 4, 5 different answers. So as you and I opine on this and give our opinions, do recognize listener who asked the question and listeners who are kind of listened to Chris and I talk about this. Other advisors would give other advice, without a doubt. This set of questions is really open to the art of financial planning as opposed to the science of financial planning. And the other reason I wanted to get into this is I don't have an opportunity right now to spend an hour, hour and a half on an EDU show. And I thought this one we could wrap up within the time frame that I have. So that's why we decided to answer this question. Okay, well, this came from someone who lives in some state. We got 50 to choose from. Pick a state. He didn't indicate anywhere on here where he is from. But nonetheless, I thought it was a fairly interesting topic. So he begins. Hi, I've learned a lot from your podcast. Thanks. Here is a short background on me. I turned 70 in April of this year. My guaranteed income from a non-taxable annuity and Social Security exceeds my monthly spending by about $1,000 a month. So let's pause there, Chris. Right now, he's getting in guaranteed income about $1,000 more than his monthly spending.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he doesn't indicate if this is just minimum dignity floor expenses, folks, or if this is all expenses. I'm going to go out on a limb and say all, because he never separated it, Chris. He never said that he said it exceeds by $1,000, but he didn't say that there were other expenses he needed to cover. So I'm assuming he's talking not only his minimum dignity floor, which if you're new listener or an old time listener, you'll know is a concept Chris and I created on our own. Minimum dignity floor refers to food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. Granted, those are five categories that can comprise dozens upon dozens upon dozens of individual expenses, but five main categories of expenses that, in our opinion, will continue for as long as you live, whether you have money or not. So Chris and I believe they should be covered with income streams that will continue for as long as you live, whether you have money or not. Very simple concept. We share that concept with clients all the time. We take that approach because, as we always say, when we age and go through retirement, we know how this ends. We are not going to get younger, stronger, and healthier. We're going to get weaker physically and mentally and emotionally. We are going to slow down. And as we age, our ability to understand financial concepts will diminish. And even though you may manage a portfolio now, we believe in trying to keep things simple as you age. And there's nothing simpler than receiving a steady stream of lifetime income that is guaranteed by a deep-pocketed third party and is not being, quote-unquote, guaranteed by some investment advisor who is trying to withdraw a certain amount of money from your assets every year and hope that the withdrawals can be supported by the returns and your portfolio doesn't run out. So that's a simple concept that we have, although it is not a widely accepted concept, I guess you could say, Chris. Most investment advisors don't practice what we preach, at least. But anything you want to add on what he has so far described?
No, not so far.
Okay. So then he goes on to say, a Monte Carlo projection indicated I shouldn't need to tap my retirement savings. I have $200,000 in retirement funds held at three different brokerages. And I have two different Roth IRAs and a traditional 401k. In addition, I have an HSA account and I have a long-term care insurance policy that will pay me only about $117,000 in lifetime benefits. So I do want to pause there. Right now, and I'm sure you're picking up on this, Chris, we don't know where he lives because he didn't tell us the state. He might be in a low-cost state or he might be in a high-cost state. I don't know. But $117,000 in long-term care benefits, if he needed help taking care of himself, is not much at all and would likely in Colorado be spent in just about a year if he needed full blown facility care. He doesn't indicate if he has... he does indicate that he has a home and it's mortgage free. It's in the very next sentence. And his home is mortgage free and might be worth anywhere between $50,000 and $200,000. Now, that's a big matzo ball window he has there for his home.
Yeah.
Now, he does indicate again, folks, he's mortgage free, but he's saying his home might... He doesn't even sound definitive, might be worth $50,000 to $200,000. So I think one of my questions was answered. He likely lives in a low-cost state or in a low-cost part of a state that might be a high-cost state, but he's living in a low-cost part of that state to have a home worth between $50,000 and $200,000. You couldn't touch that in the state of Colorado. So I think he lives in a low-cost state. He does have some home equity, but he doesn't have much, in my opinion, in protection if he needed long-term care. I don't want to turn this into an aging assistance long-term care discussion Now, the good news would be if he ever did have to go into a facility, he is bringing in a little over $3,000, about $3,700 in my math of monthly income. How did I come up with that? He said his monthly spending is, I didn't read this whole part, his monthly spending is $2,780, and his secure income between the annuity and Social Security exceeds that by about $1,000. So I simply said, okay, he's got to be making around $3,780 of lifetime guaranteed income, and he currently has expenses of about $2,780. If he did need some type of long-term care assistance and he left his house, so he's no longer living in the house, all of that money could go to his care, as well as the equity in his home. His home is mortgage-free and could be worth anywhere between $50,000 and $200,000. So I do want to point some of that out. And again, we don't have a lot of info, Chris. I'm just trying to extrapolate a lot from what he wrote. So far, with everything in these two paragraphs, anything you want to add to his situation right now?
My first reaction is I don't think he's in as good a situation as he thinks. I think you've already alluded to a little bit of it. The long-term care that he's hanging his hat on is not a particularly substantial benefit if he actually needs that care. Now, I admit he's got that secure income coming in. If he's single, doesn't have to support a spouse if he were to be institutionalized. He does have the safety net of Medicaid if it gets to that point. But he isn't, you know, kind of set for life with no worries by any means. I'm also concerned a bit with inflationary risks for him and unanticipated expenses in the future. And that's kind of part of my comment about I don't think he has much of a cushion, as nearly as much as he thinks he does.
Right. Right now, listener, what Chris is saying, the $1,000 a month cushioning, and you didn't break down for us, listener, how much of your expenses. You did say you have $2,780 a month of expenses, and your secure income exceeds that by $1,000. But you didn't break that out for us and tell us how much of that expenses is your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. Those five categories of expenses go up at rates of inflation far higher than any type of inflationary increase, COLA increase they call it, cost of living adjustment to Social Security. And your annuity, your non-qualified private annuity, if you will, that probably doesn't have any type of increase in it at all, I would guess.
Yeah,
it might.
They're more common without it, for sure. We don't know because he hasn't said, but I would be willing to bet as well it's likely that he has a flat annuity, which means that that cushion he has is going to shrink over time. And I'd say, just doing a little back of the envelope math, I would say that he could be in jeopardy of that cushion being gone within 10 years, maybe faster, depending on the makeup of his expense basket that he's got there, that $2,780 that he has.
Exactly. Now, I might not be as pessimistic as Chris, but Chris does more planning in the office right now than I do. My position in the office has changed over the past 2 years, and I do less planning and I do more administrative work as far as running the darn business. But that said, it is possible, Chris, if he lives in a low-cost part of the country, his inflationary pressure might not be as great as what we're thinking for some other people that we may be working with whose inflationary pressures on minimum dignity floor is far greater.
Yeah.
So perhaps 10 years is not, maybe it's not quite as bad. I think what we're trying to convey to you, though, listener and listeners who are trying to do calculations like this on your own, you really need to be projecting your $2,780 of current expenses forward. You're only 70. You could live another 18 to 25 years, and maybe more, but realistically 18 to 25, maybe less, maybe more. I don't know too much about your health. I'm just going in generalized terms. So you do need to project that forward, because there could be a point in time where you won't have enough secure income. So do keep that in mind, because again, we don't know how much of that 2,780 is minimum dignity floor and how much is fun. Fun expenses have two unique characteristics, and don't forget this, listeners. And he seems to be mixing both of his together. Chris and I recommend strongly you separate yours out. Fun expenses, first of all, go up at rates of inflation far lower than minimum dignity floor expenses. And number two, they drop as you age. You just will not be spending as much on fun as you age. Mm-hmm. But minimum dignity floor expenses continue to go up methodically and at rates of inflation that greatly exceed any type of cost of living adjustments to Social Security and this particular person's annuity payments. Okay, so I don't want to beat that horse to death. I want to keep getting into his other questions. Okay, so he has, as I said, Chris, three accounts, two Roth IRAs and a traditional 401k. He doesn't break out how much money is in each one. He just tells us he has $200,000 in retirement savings, but he doesn't tell us how much is in the traditional 401k and how much are in his two Roth IRAs. Nor does he tell us if he's married or not. Part of me thinks he might be, because there's two Roth IRAs. Why else would he have two Roths? You only really need one. You can combine them. But he never mentions a wife at all, or a combined Social Security or a spousal or survivor benefit or anything like that. So I don't know if he's married or not. But for now, we can only go with what we know. Three brokerage accounts, two Roths, one traditional, $200,000 combined in them, plus an HSA account. And then again, a house that might, he's not sure, might be worth anywhere between $50,000 and $200,000. I would encourage, listener, you get a better idea what your house is worth, only because that's a big difference. And you do say there's no mortgage, which is great. That means you have some equity in that home. And that equity is an asset that can be spent. He does indicate, Chris, that he also has $30,000 of cash in the bank. And that makes sense. He says he's running a surplus every month of $1,000. So I would guess it's just going into his bank. It can't go into the Roth or the 401k. And he has no particular need to pass on an inheritance. So that tells me he may be a single man and may have no children, or may have children but sees no need to pass them on any type of guaranteed inheritance. So as a planner, that's telling me, and I'm sure it's also telling you, Chris, the $50,000 to $200,000 of equity in his home is an asset that he could tap. And in my mind, he may want to earmark tapping that as part of his aging assistant slash long-term care plan if he ever needs it. Not only because it makes sense, but he would have to before any type of Medicaid would kick in and help him. They would force him to use the equity in his home and all his assets. You can't go into a facility and also keep your home. The only way you can keep the home is if you have a spouse at home who's living in it. So he should start looking at his home equity in that light, but also get a better handle of if he has $200,000 of equity or $50,000 of equity. That would be like someone with a $500,000 home saying to us, I don't know if the home is worth $500,000 or $2 million. I mean, it's just a huge difference.
Yeah.
So he's got to get a better handle, in my opinion, on what his equity is worth, but also start looking at it and understanding that that home equity would likely go to help supplement his long-term care policy, which at $117,000 of lifetime benefits is not going to go very far, unless he lives in a very low-cost state in Kansas, which at least last time I checked, which was several years ago, I confess, it had some of the lowest long-term care annualized expenses in the United States of about $50,000 or so a year, whereas a state like Alaska had the highest. You would think it was California, but it was actually Alaska, with over $200,000 a year for full-blown nursing home care. So he doesn't indicate if he's a Kansan or an Alaskan. And it could be a big difference with that $117,000.
Yeah, and if the house is really worth more towards the high end of that, I'd feel a lot better about his situation dealing with aging assistance and long-term care potentials. But 50 doesn't add a whole lot of extra cushion there. And if you think about it, the house, if it's worth 200, that's half of his total net worth. If he's got a couple hundred in retirement funds and another couple hundred in the house, 50 to 200 is a huge percentage difference. So I agree, not that he needs to value it so he can run out and sell it or do something to it, but to realize what he's really got as far as equity to help him out if he actually needs it. Now, ultimately, if he truly has no kids and if he drains every one of his resources and he lives somewhere where a Medicaid bed, if it is a long-term care issue, is not that much of a downside for him, then maybe it's not as big a risk as what we're talking about here in his particular circumstance. But these are the types of conversations we would have with him if he was across the desk talking to us. But we're just kind of supposing this and supposing that to decipher what might be appropriate for this guy to consider.
Exactly. So he gets into three questions. So listeners, with all this background of what he wrote, plus Chris and I giving our opinion and extrapolating what we think might be the situation, we were just trying to lay out for you how planners think and how I thought when I read this email. And how I kind of went deeper in and started trying to extrapolate, well, he must be in this situation or that, or this could be going on. So with this background, his questions, Chris, have more to do with investing than retirement. Whereas you and I, one of the last things I ever thought of was investing for this guy, was all these other things that we've mentioned. Mm-hmm. Minimum dignity floor, inflationary pressures, long-term care. Does he have a wife or not? Is there any survivor and spousal benefits? What is the house truly worth? These are the things that I was thinking of, but his questions, Chris, all revolve around investing. And that kind of threw up a red flag to me, listeners. And the reason is, I don't know how many times we have to say it, investment management is not financial planning. It's not. They are two separate disciplines. Even in my own practice, my own office, Chris and I don't do investment management. We offer it. Our firm definitely offers it. And we're going to be talking more about it with our listeners in the not too distant future. We've made that decision. We want to try to educate you guys a little on our opinion of that, which is as radical as our opinion on retirement planning. But one of the things we often tell people is that there is a difference, Chris, between an investment advisor and a financial planner. And all his questions revolve around investments and necessarily planning. Yeah,
that was a concern for me, too, as you prefaced this, kind of gave me the quick summary of this before we got on the podcast, that his focus is definitely in that area. And I think he shouldn't have just automatically shifted his focus from his core retirement plan situation, his financial situation overall, over to just concentrating on the investment side, because I don't think he has as ironclad situation as he seems to believe he does.
Nope, I agree. And he indicates Monte Carlo. He doesn't say if he ran a full plan, if he did some online website after 20 minutes of typing in data, he gets a quick Monte Carlo regurgitated number out, which that plan is as worthless as the, well, I can't even say paper it's printed on, but he doesn't indicate if he has a planner. He does ask a question on if we think he needs a planner. So maybe he does have one, but because his questions, as I read them in a second, all involve, for the most part, investment questions and investment management, if he does have a planner, I'm going to go out on a limb, Chris, and assume this planner is more of an investment advisor, perhaps an investment advisor utilizing what the industry does, AUM, assets under management. Let's just gather these assets, charge 1%, and provide and Christianize biased, I admit, opinion, a rather, I don't want to say totally useless, but questionable value retirement plan built upon probability statistics and Monte Carlo projections, and not what we believe in, minimum dignity floor, go-go, slow-go, no-go, fund spending, things of that nature. So let's get into his question. Question one, do you think it would make sense to consolidate all my investments to the same brokerage? Because remember, he said he has three brokerages with two Roth IRAs and a traditional 401k. So listener, if I'm understanding this correctly, sounds to me like you have three different plan custodians. You're calling them brokerages. You have a Roth IRA at custodian A, a Roth IRA at custodian B, and a 401k at custodian C. So in other words, you might have money at Vanguard, Fidelity, and T. Rowe Price. Again, I'm just making that up. But that's how I interpret that. What about you, Chris?
I agree. That's what it sounds like to me, too, which sounds overly complicated in his circumstances.
Exactly. So I think Chris and I are on the same page, listener. I have no problem with you consolidating them because it's going to be easier. Remember what we always say. And if you've listened to the five-part series Chris and I did almost a year ago now, I think it's about 10 months ago now, we did it in January of 2020, a five-part series on our process. And the first two of the five parts were more about the why we believe in doing things the way we do it, and then the last three were how we do it. The why is crucial to us. And one of the things we fixate on is we tell people it is an explicit, not implicit, but explicit requirement, in our opinion, that the quote-unquote younger you puts it, and I apologize for my personal phone that's ringing there. You know who this is, Chris? It's like the fifth call I've gotten today, those stupid polls on the election. But there's no way I can figure out how to silence my home phone. You're going to have to show me how to keep it from ringing besides just ripping it out of the wall.
I was going to say, just unplug it from the wall.
It's just, oh, God, I hate this time of year. Yeah. All right. So anyway,
bear with it. Less than 2 weeks.
Yes, I know. But back to what I was trying to say before the
pollsters interrupted.
Pollsters interrupted me. Okay, so what we were trying to say, it is an explicit, not implicit requirement that the younger you put in place a plan to take care of the older you as simple as possible. Because don't forget, folks, I know we don't like to think of this, but as we age, our ability to understand financial concepts will diminish. We do slow down mentally. Nobody likes to admit that at all, but we know it can happen. And for some of us, it happens at rates far greater than others. So to have three separate plan custodians, now granted, Roth IRAs, Chris, don't require required minimum distributions, so it's not like he's going to need to be reaching out to them. But at some point in the future, if he needs money from one or the other, he's got to deal with two different custodians. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem, in my opinion, to make any sense. And then he has a third custodian with a 401k. So that question becomes, should he take the 401k and move it? Well, he can't move it to another 401k unless he's working, and he doesn't indicate that at all. So he has to then move it to an IRA. And that opens up a little bit of can of worms. He wants to make sure that if he moves it to a IRA custodian, it should be the same IRA custodian that at least one of his Roth IRAs are at. You don't want to choose a third custodian yet again. And in my opinion, you don't need two separate Roth IRAs unless there's a specific reason you've done that and you haven't indicated to us there is. So I think it would be a lot easier for him to choose one custodian at the very least for his two Roth IRAs. But it is also possible it would make sense to move his 401k into the IRA. But when you move 401ks, you run into a lot of rules and a lot of regulatory hurdles if you're using an investment advisor, because the investment advisor needs to make sure that the fees of your IRA are going to be reasonable when compared to the fees in the 401k. But if you're doing it on your own, moving it is a little less benign because it's decisions you make and you're doing it on your own. But do keep in mind, if you work with a investment advisor, they're most likely going to have paperwork that you're going to have to complete where they can show that they've evaluated your 401k and the IRA. And from a fiduciary standpoint, at the very least, it does make sense to move it.
And those rules are in place to protect people, because in the past, a lot of indiscriminate advice to roll your 401k into an IRA was occurring by advisors looking to AUM you, and ended up putting people into IRA structures that were more costly and fee-laden than the 401k they came with, and they really weren't made aware of that situation. So these rules came up because of that. So I like these rules in general. I'm not a huge fan of rules overall because it just adds more paperwork and complexity to things. But if it prevents people from taking advantage of others, there's rules we all have to follow.
Correct. So I like the idea of it, listener, to have one custodian. So your question is, does it make sense? I would say yes. What do you think, Chris? Mm-hmm.
I agree. Unless he really likes juggling the three separately. And even if he does now, there's going to be a point in time where I'm convinced he won't really enjoy that. And the simplicity of a one-stop shop to go and check your balances and move money around and take a distribution. You only have to remember one place. You only have to have one login if you're doing it online, or one phone call to make to deal with it. You're not juggling and trying to get two different entities to deal with each other and things like that. I'm all a fan of simplicity. Unless there's a reason to be more complicated, I believe the goal should be simplicity.
Okay. And then he asks, would it make sense for me to shift all my investments into target date funds, perhaps a 2030 or a different target date fund? I could use one target date fund, or I could use more than one. Okay, I'm going to pause there. I could do a whole EDU show on target date funds, and perhaps we should in the future. And I can't do that because it's a Friday evening and Chris and I need to wrap up shortly and y'all listeners would get bored. So what he essentially is asking, Chris, is does he need a bunch of individual investments, or would he be okay or better off with one well-managed, diversified fund in this case, or two or three well-managed, diversified funds? In other words, a little bit more simplicity. Mm-hmm. I would say this, listener. Investment advisors would love you to think investing needs to be complex, that you need them, that you need to pay them 1.25%, 1.5% of your assets every year, because you can't do this on your own. It's just incredibly complex. And investing needs an active manager to sit there and hold your hand and buy all these different investments. You got $200,000 broken into three accounts. I would assume no one account is that big, listener. And if you were working with my firm, I would be encouraging you, not necessarily for a target date fund for a variety of different reasons. I have nothing against them inherently. I'm not 100% convinced it would be the perfect option for you. There's other types of funds called allocation funds, which are similar to, they're like a kissing cousin to a target date fund. An allocation fund, you choose a specific allocation. They come in three flavors like Neapolitan ice cream, but instead of strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla, they come in conservative, moderate, and aggressive. So an allocation fund differs from a target date fund in that it will maintain that allocation, conservative, moderate, or aggressive, for the life, Chris, of the fund. It doesn't change.
Right.
You buy a conservative allocation fund, it's conservative. You buy a moderate, it's moderate. You buy aggressive, it's aggressive. Whereas a target date fund will cycle and move. So what you have to make sure is the current, what they call the glide path, is the time in a target date fund that it intends to be at its final education, at its final allocation.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure the ultimate final allocation matches what your risk tolerance and risk capacity are, and that the glide path matches where you are. You're 70, and we don't quite know yet what that $200,000 is earmarked for.
This, yeah, and that's the
problem.
Focus for me is, I would say, before you start talking specific places to put it, he needs to decide where, what he wants that money to do or be available for.
Exactly. It's, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, you just have to assign it its job. I talk jobs. You, Jim, you've got your little saying, which I really like, so I'll let you say it.
Yeah, I often say, how can we tell you what to do with your money until we know what your money has to do for you?
Right.
So you're leading with a product. Should I use a target date fund, and should I use a 2030 fund? I don't know. I have nothing against a target date fund. So let me stop here and say, I like your idea of simplicity, listener, because you don't have much money. Oftentimes, as a firm, when we manage assets or help clients manage assets, we explain to them first, we call them convenience portfolios, because most of our clients are smart enough to manage their own money. The question becomes, do you want to? Or do you want us to do it for you as a convenience? So we'll get deeper into how we manage assets. But a lot of times, and I explained this not too long ago on an EDU show, we take your assets and start slicing it into different sleeves. That's what our trading software calls it, but we're calling it pie slices, using the analogy of a cherry pie. But oftentimes, Chris, when we start slicing assets into these cherry pie slices, if you will, or sleeves, like our trading software calls it, we try to simplify each pie slice as best we can. And oftentimes we might use one of these allocation funds that I've indicated to you, because the allocation perfectly matches what that pie slice should be, and there's no need to take on more complexity. So you need to look at your $200,000, listener, and earmark what's it for. And perhaps a 2030 target date fund would be appropriate. But remember, that target date fund is changing. And 2030, is that where the final allocation begins? Or is it, that's called a two fund. In other words, when 2030 is hit, the final allocation will be set in 2030. Or is it a through fund, meaning in 2030 is when the glide path begins, Chris, and it's still another 20 years past then when it will enter its final allocation? So one of the things, listeners, I don't like about target date funds is they're confusing as hell. They don't work the way you think, that you just fixate on the year, and in that year, this fund is going to be at its most conservative. Some are like that, some are not. And then you still have to read the prospectus to figure out what its final allocation is going to be and when the hell does it get there. That's called the glide path. Whereas an allocation fund, Chris, Conservative is a conservative, a moderate is a moderate, and an aggressive is an aggressive. It's pretty easy. So if you're looking for simplicity, the target date fund might not quite be as easy as you think. But I like the idea, listener, of not needing, or at least not utilizing, a complex portfolio with 24 different investments for $200,000. You don't need that level of complexity and diversification, for, in my opinion, for such a small account. And a well-allocated fund could be all you need. The question is if you'd be better served with an allocation or a target date fund. I smell a EDU show on the horizon, Chris, the difference between an allocation and a target date fund.
But let me clarify.
Get into that deep right now.
Yeah, let me clarify one thing Jim said, because I don't want people to misinterpret it. He's not downplaying diversification. You can get effective diversification simply in a small portfolio with simple choices. So
absolutely.
Yes, diversification is valuable. So don't forego diversifying just because the account is small. Eons ago, it was difficult to diversify a small amount. But these days, because of the structure of what is available, you can easily diversify really any amounts that you've got.
You could. He could easily do this with a bunch of passive ETFs because there's no minimums. You can buy them on an exchange. It's very easy. But it's complex, relatively speaking, to the size of his account. An allocation fund or a target date fund are diversified.
Right.
That's why I like
that. That's my point. That's my point. The way you said it, I think people might interpret it as not diversifying. You're diversifying by choosing the right thing that's diversified in and of itself.
Right. And that's what these funds exist for.
Yeah.
They are already diversified. The funds themselves are handling all the diversification. And even though you may own one fund, it is well diversified. That's what these funds are designed for. They're designed for this man's very situation. I'm just not convinced the target date fund is more appropriate than the allocation fund.
Right.
So the short answer, listener, should you consider them? Absolutely. Is a 2031 appropriate? I have no idea, because I still don't know what that money needs to do for you. I like the idea of consolidating with one custodian. I like the idea of using some type of simplified fund that within its structure, it is diversified with cash, stocks, and bonds and alternatives and all of this. So that would be an allocation fund or a target date fund. I am not convinced a target date fund is the ideal option for you, and target date funds are much more complex to understand than an allocation fund. An allocation fund is straightforward. A conservative allocation fund is conservative, and it usually will disclose if it's going to be 70-30, which is usually what it is, 70% bonds, 30% equities. And it'll be a conservative allocation, and the managers manage it. And then a moderate would be probably 60-40 or 50-50 stocks to bonds. And an aggressive would be 70-30 stocks to bonds. So it's well diversified and easy to understand. So that's, Chris and I are on the same page there. His final question. This one made me smile, Chris, and it'll make you smile too. He says, if I put all my funds in target date funds or an allocation fund, I'll throw that in. Don't give that up, listener. Do I really need to retain a financial advisor on a continuing basis as opposed to just periodically hiring one if I need them? So let me say, listener, do you need a financial advisor? Yes. Do you need an investment advisor? Probably no. Separate the two. A financial advisor is what I would call a financial planner. Although under regulation best interest passed by the SEC this year, brokers cannot call themselves advisors. So you're going to see more brokers calling themselves planners, muddying the waters even more.
Yeah.
So do you need an investment advisor is what you're asking? No. If you have just one fund, I don't think you need an investment advisor, but you can still benefit from a true financial planner. Mm-hmm. And now the question is going to be, Chris, how is that planner going to charge him? If that planner insists on charging through what is known in the industry as AUM, assets under management, in other words, they want to hold your assets and bill you every year based on a percentage of your assets, then you're going to find a lot of investment advisors slash financial planners won't work with you on an as-needed basis. So it's really going to come down to how is your financial planner. You need a planner. You don't need an investment advisor. And especially if you're going to use a target date fund that you choose on your own or an allocation fund that you choose on your own, do you need to pay someone 1% of that a year to give you financial planning advice? Hell no. What you need is an financial planner who is willing to say, hey, I will work with you and here's my minimum price every year, or call me as you need me. I charge X amount of dollars per hour and I have a minimum X amount of minutes that I bill for. That type of advisor is kind of one you need. That's called as needed financial planning. And it's usually done by hourly agreements. And there are advisors that exist in that realm. The Garrett Planning Network is a whole network of advisors who do that very type of business model. But you might find a lot of investment advisors who masquerade themselves as financial planners, but they're only going to want to work with you if you have them, quote unquote, manage your money, or a broker who will sell you a commissioned base allocation fund or target date fund. So be aware of that. You might find some investment advisors who will call themselves financial planners and say, hey, you really should buy this fund. But that fund could be a commissioned-based fund where they're being paid every year by the fund company to maintain a relationship with you, but that money is coming from you through higher fees associated with that fund. So you're going to have to get a really good understanding of how you're paying for the advice. So when you ask, do I need a financial advisor? I want to change that term to, do I need an investment advisor or a financial planner? In my opinion, you need a financial planner. How do you pay that financial planner needs to be fully disclosed and laid out to you. If they're being paid through managing your money, they might be more of an investment advisor masquerading as a financial planner. But you need to find out from them, how are they going to bill you? Will they bill you by the hour? Can you maintain your own portfolio? Look, Mr. and Mrs. Advisor, I don't want anything to do with you touching my money. I'm going to manage it myself over here at Vanguard, all you affectionately called Vanguardians, as Chris and I call you. But I'd love to be able to counsel with you on an as-needed basis. Are you willing to work with me? That's how I would go about trying to find someone to help you. And investment advisors who want to manage your money won't work with you, listener, because they don't have your money. They're not charging you a percentage of your assets. What you are asking for is an as-needed financial planner. And I think that's all you need if you can get good advice. That's my take. What is your take, Chris?
I agree. Generally, the one thing that having your assets somewhere connected with a person that you trust, especially if you're single. In this particular case, we're interpreting his scenario since there's no mention of a spouse that he's single. If he doesn't have anyone else kind of watching over his shoulder a little bit, there is the potential that he'll do something either by a slip up or a mistake or forget to do something, if you know his mental capacities degrade a bit, and if there's no one else in the mix, something might happen. Now, not likely. This isn't something that happens all the time, but it does happen. And so that would be the only concern I would have. And I'm not saying it's worth going out and paying someone, you know, 1-1.5% to have this, but I think you might be able to find the right relationship with someone who would, you know, be there as a guiding force so that when you took your RMDs, they were, you know, correct, and you didn't do it twice in a year when you didn't mean to, or you forgot to take them, or you, some of those types of things, I think you're just more susceptible to that when you're alone. You don't realize sometimes your own aging effects. So I'd throw that out there as something to consider. Not, you know, absolutely great for everybody, but I think there is some value in that as well.
No, I would freely, totally agree with you on that. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because this is a big thing with Ed Slott. He believes passionately that people should have an advisor as they age for that very reason. In fact, on this very podcast, Chris, we've talked about cases mm-hmm. where the question was brought up that if there was an advisor involved, would they have picked up on some of these mistakes people were making, or people who were being robbed blindly mm-hmm. By other family members? Would an advisor have seen that? So I love that Chris mentioned this. Here's going to be the problem, listener, and listeners in general. And I'll talk to you openly as someone who has a business. I would love to be able to have a model that Chris just described, but I can't do it.
It's a little rough.
It's not profitable.
Yeah.
Because here's how it would have to be. You would, if someone, and we do have people who have accounts with us, these are generally small people that have been with me for a very long time, and I want to maintain a relationship with them. And I don't charge them anything, and they have accounts with me. And what they do is on an as-needed basis, hire me by the hour, which is exactly what this man is describing. I will not take new people on like that. And here's why. I do it for the people that I've been working with for a very long time, mostly because I like them, they're personal friends, and I almost feel obligated. I don't want to cut them free, Chris, to the lions and tigers and bears that are out there. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, and you will admit, and what is difficult on this for us listeners, is we are not actively managing that money. I don't have discretion on their accounts. I can't make trades or do anything. I can see if things are being done, but we're not actively looking at it. And I cannot go in there and just on my own start doing something and then send them a bill. I'm not allowed to do that. In order for me to be more involved and look at, you need to be in an advisory relationship where I have you on this different platform and I can see what's going on, and I'm monitoring the investments and the withdrawals, and I'm being notified if things are happening. So one of the things that some advisors are trying to do is come up, listeners, with what is more of a subscription model, and to say to people, look, if you want me to keep an eye on things, I've got to have the money over here where I can see it. How could I see it, listener, if you are a do-it-yourselfer at Vanguard and you want to hire me on an as-needed basis? Great, but I can't look at your account and see if someone is draining it. Now, Vanguard can, but they're not being hired to do that. They're just a custodian. They're not going to question what's happening. So if you need or want an advisor, as Chris has said, as you age, keeping an eye on things, you almost will need to be in an ongoing type of advisory relationship where you are paying an ongoing fee to an advisor to actually be doing what Chris said, keeping a second set of eyes on things. watching to see when distribution's happening, questioning why are these distributions happening. And that does require, Chris, some type of ongoing relationship. Mm-hmm. And it does require me to be compensated. I can't do things for free for everyone. I'd go out of business. So we would have to say, look, I can do that. And if you don't want to pay me an advisory management fee, I have a minimum ongoing fee of X amount of dollars, and we're going to bill you quarterly for that. And here's what we're going to do for you. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do the other thing. So that's going to be one of the difficulties you run into, listener. I think right now, while you still have all your mental facilities, you could keep managing your money. But as you age, if you want someone to start looking over your shoulder and making sure RMDs are being taken, making sure you don't see any strange withdrawals, or if a withdrawal beyond a regularly scheduled RMD is happening, someone is reaching out to you and saying, hey, I noticed $30,000 was taken out of your IRA. Is everything okay? Do you want to chat about it? Someone who's going to be looking at it, you need an ongoing relationship. Now, the question is, will that ongoing relationship, the fee associated with it, be based on the size of your assets? That would be the AUM model. And again, we have nothing against that model if the investment advisor is also a planner and is looking at things like this. Or you could get into more of a subscription model, a quarterly subscription model, where you're going to pay X amount of dollars every quarter. And the advisor is laying out, Chris, quite explicitly what they will be doing every year. And maybe one of those is, we're going to watch your account for distributions beyond the regularly scheduled RMD, and we will contact you if there are any distributions to make sure those distributions were appropriate or something like that. So I'm getting a little deep into the weeds, but to have just an as-needed hourly advisor, it's going to be real difficult if you also want that advisor to be monitoring everything else and making sure nothing nefarious is going on.
Right.
That advisor is probably going to need a more ongoing type of fee to compensate not only him, maybe his employees. Remember, if it's me and I assign an employee to a case and say, hey, every month I want you to look at this gentleman's account, and if any distribution is taken, bring it to my attention. I've got to pay an employee, Chris, to do that. So I need to make sure the firm is generating enough money for me to cover my overhead. So we start getting into either an AUM model or at least a subscription model. So I do want to make mention of that.
Yeah, and my point was really perfectly aligned with that, that you wouldn't get this. This is a reason why you might want to consider a step beyond the hourly for advice model, because you wouldn't get that level of monitoring and kind of someone over your shoulder that if you find it valuable, you'd have to take a step a little deeper into a relationship with an advisor that'd be willing to do that either, like Jim said, under a subscription type thing probably, or an AUM type of a situation at a reasonable enough fee that you were comfortable, that you were getting value for the fee that you were paying.
Right. You don't want to pay, in my opinion, you don't want to pay 1% of your assets, which would be $2,000 a year,
yeah,
for someone to simply contact you if they happen to see a distribution that's out of the ordinary. So again, as Chris said, it's got to be a reasonable fee in our opinion. And you may not get this level of service at some of these larger custodians with, granted, great low fees, but the adage you get what you pay for is it comes to mind. And you might not get that at some of these custodians where they're not going to monitor that for you. But again, these are things that you need to research with your custodian and your advisor if you're working with one. And I do feel people can benefit from advisors. Hell, it's what I do for a living. I think we definitely add a lot of value. I question the value we add or any advisor would add on the investment management side, only because I think it's been commoditized and computers and indexes and algorithms are a lot cheaper than staff. So a lot of investment management, Chris, can be done a lot cheaper than what advisors are doing. But planning and monitoring, that is where advisors can really add a lot of value. The question is, how are they going to charge you for that? And what are they going to charge you for that? And is it worth it? Yeah. And that's something you're going to have to evaluate as you interview advisors. And do remember, there is a difference between an investment advisor who is really just going to manage money and a financial planner who is going to get more involved. Even in this question you asked, how Chris and I dug deep and looked at all these different things, that's what an investment, that's what a financial planner would do. So yes, I think you could benefit from an advisor. I don't know if long-term an hourly agreement would work. I wouldn't do this by the hour. I couldn't find a problem and then call you and say, hey, is this okay? And then send you a bill because I looked at it and found something. Yeah. I would need something on a more regular basis because I have to assign someone to check your account to make sure that we're keeping track of what we're supposed to keep track of and maintaining the power of attorneys and the contact people we're supposed to contact if something doesn't look right and all this other stuff that we have to do. We do need to be compensated for that. I mean, there's just no other way around it. So do keep that in mind as you start working on an advisor. We should do another EDU show on the whole advisory industry, or a series of shows on the industry, how you pay, how it's evolving, what it used to be like. I think that would be a good set of EDUs. We'll also consider those in the future. Yep. All right. That's about it for me.
Yep. Sounds good. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us again on the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition. If you've got kind of an in-depth question that you'd like us to tackle in an extended format like this, certainly reach out to us on our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can send in smaller questions that we do on our Q&A show that you're probably familiar with. These extended shows sometimes are a topic that we come up with, kind of like last week's when I did the Social Security changes update for 2021. Or there'll be an idea from a listener, which was the format for today. So we never know what we're going to do until usually a few minutes before, unless we've got something specific we've planned out, like some of our estate planning shows we plan out in advance. But we appreciate everybody listening and look forward to chatting with you again next week. You have a nice weekend, Jim.
Thank you. You have a great weekend, and I will talk to you and everybody next week.
Bye-bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.